Hey everybody, Jay Cooper, Carlos Collazo, Baseball America Draft Podcast. As we are every week, we are here to talk, to get you ready for the 2026 MLB Draft. As we record this, 30 days away, 29 days by the time you're listening to this. But speaking of that, there is a 30 things to know piece that Carlos wrote that is up at baseballamerica.com. Check that out. There is a lot going on, a lot that's going to happen over the next few weeks. We're going to do today, the big thing we're going to do today is you saw a mock draft that Carlos put out on Monday. And Carlos said at the time, it's like, hey, here's what I'm hearing. It's still a lot of chalk. Today, we're going to approach it, though. That doesn't mean that things are locked in, right? I think we had the same seven picks as the last time. But that doesn't mean in any way that, like, oh, that's how this is going to play out. Today, we're going to do a mock draft, kind of an alternate reality mock. But all of these are plausible. All of these are things that there are rumors out there. There are that this is reporting that Carlos has heard. These aren't something where we're going to say, hey, this guy who has never been linked to this team, who's not really any chance going to be a top 10 pick, is going to be in the top 10 to this to examine it. No, we're looking at this from, you could take this as a plausible, but just we're going to take like the lesser likelihood cases, right? Mm. So we're going to get into that. But before we do that, let's just lay out a little bit. So we're now less than a month away from the draft, finally, as those of us who grew up under the old schedule, like this right now, it'd be like, it would be a very different experience. We would be analyzing the draft at this point in many years because, it was going on during College World Series a lot of times or Super Regionals or things like that. Now it's still far away, but we do have things coming up. Obviously, College World Series will be going on starting the day, Friday, the day you're listening to this, if you got it on the first day. That'll be going on for a couple of weeks. There are still prospects who will absolutely, what they do there will be very important. But I did want to ask you, Carlos, the flip side of that is we also have the draft combine coming up June 22nd through 24th, which obviously is open to a lot more players than our available to play in the College World Series, that can play in the College World Series. But how important and in what ways is the draft combine important for teams and players?
Yeah, I would say it's beyond just the draft combine as well. But the reason the combine is important is because you're getting a lot of high priority players. MLB teams go around and they invite the top 300 players that they kind of collectively decide on to invite to the combine. And a lot of those players will come and do on-field workouts. That in and of itself is very useful, getting TrackMan data, athletic testing data for high school players, college players who maybe don't have the largest sample. It's useful for players who maybe dealt with injuries throughout the season and didn't get a full spring. Being able to come back and show that you're healthy is useful. So you'll have bullpen sessions, you'll have batting practice, you'll have in and outs, fielders showing what they can do in the infield, outfielders making throws, catchers popping behind the plate. There's a high school game that always happens. And then probably the most important from the combine, from the team's perspective, is just the opportunity to spend a lot of time actually talking with the players. All the teams have suites booked out at Chase Field where essentially as the combine is going on, the teams are all cycling different players through, players that they're interested in, the decision makers, and some teams bring pretty big scouting staffs in to just chat with the players, ask them questions, try to get a better feel for what they're like, what their mentality is, if there are any issues or questions that have come up with a player throughout their career or throughout the spring, those can be addressed there. And then I guess also the medical that happens with the combine, players have the opportunity to go through medical processes. And if they do that, all that information gets sent to all the teams. And obviously that is super important as well.
And doing that, again, there is a push pull here. And doing that also ensures as a player that if you are drafted, like you've essentially covered yourself for if a team then says there's something medical wise or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. In a way. Because you have a threshold that if you've gone through the
medical. If you go through the medical, what is the threshold? 60 or 75%? I don't remember the number.
Right. So there's a threshold where you are guaranteed to get
right. If they take you, you've submitted the medical, they have to offer you at least that minimum if you've gone through the medical process.
Whereas if you haven't, then they don't have to do that.
Correct. Yep.
So that's coming up. Obviously, there will still be some players, I would say, especially players who were injured during the season or whatever, you will have some going on to summer college leagues from the college side, maybe on the, and some on the high school side too. We've seen this now, you know, with players from who've just graduated high school. It's a very good way to kind of show what you can do, you know, to go out there and kind of, we have enough time now. So, so that's coming up as well. So it's not over by any stretch. It's not like, okay, everyone's now just going to shut it down here until the draft rolls around. But there's obviously also a lot of analysis, a lot of lining up of things that have already been gathered that's going on now. And today, like we said, we're going to jump in and do kind of a podcast mock draft. And we really are. This is kind of an alt mock draft, I would say. Like Carlos put one out. Check it out. BaseballAmerica.com this week. But what we're doing here is what I would describe is these are all, again, these are plausible options. And one first domino falls, everything else starts to kind of change as well. Mm-hmm. So let's start with, obviously, the White Sox are pick number one. Diving in, you said, like, I think you were on the Hot Sheet show this week, you said, and I know we've had conversation about this. Your reporting is that UCLA shortstop Rock Chulowski, who's been our number one prospect kind of coast to coast, remains the most likely choice here. But at the same time, as you would expect, it is also not something where he is the put it down, write it in ink, number one pick by any stretch of the imagination.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't feel as locked in as maybe Adley Rutschman was in 2019 when he was the equivalent kind of consensus top player in the class that Rock is today. And I think part of that is because Grady Emerson has maybe narrowed the gap between the two this spring. Everything that I've been hearing from teams maybe indicates that just the margin between those two players are a little bit closer. And then I think the third player who's in consideration by everything that I've heard from people around the game is that Von Lackey at Georgia Tech, the season that he's just had, has kind of put him in the top tier prospects as well. I get the sense that the most likely candidates for the White Sox for one are Rock, then Grady, then Von Lackey in that order. I would be pretty stunned if it was someone who is not one of those three players at the top this year. And I think basically the entirety of the time we've been doing mock drafts, Rock Chulowski just feels like the most likely name. And so he's been the pick. It feels the mocks, I always struggle with it too, because if you have one pick repeatedly for a team, I think that can sometimes signal to readers that we are increasingly certain that's the pick.
That's not what we're saying.
That's not the case. It's just you have to pick who you think is most likely. I don't want to pivot to someone who I think is less likely just to shake things up. But I think this is what's going to be useful about this exercise. We can kind of do an alternative mock and say, hey, we're hearing this. This could happen. So if the White Sox take Grady Emerson, who let's plug in for number one for the White Sox here, shortstop out of Texas, I think this could legitimately happen. I mean, the case for Grady Emerson we can get into as we get closer to the draft. But like, ultimately, I think the simplest case for him is, hey, this is the best pure hitter in this year's class. There's a lot of confidence in Grady Emerson's hitting ability. The hit tool is the most important tool for position players. And it's not like he's lacking in other tools as well. He does not have elite secondary tools. He is not the sort of outlier athlete that a Jacob Lombard is or a Bobby Witt Jr. was. He doesn't have that present power that you can look at with Rock now. But all of his tools, beyond the hit tool, I think you could say are solid average or above average across the board.
To go back to that 2019 draft, right, where it was Adley at the top, the player, and again, we're talking about an infielder versus an outfielder, but I would say that, look, when you say that, like, it reminds me when we're talking about Riley Green back then, right, where Riley Green was a very good hitter. That was the thing that everyone was very comfortable about.
Yeah.
Was he going to be a center fielder? Who knows? He may end up being a corner, which he ended up being a corner.
Yeah.
But it was the bat that was basically made him a top of the draft prospect. Again, I don't want to make that is a illusion, not a perfect analogy, because Grady Emerson, when you talk about this.
I actually like that better, because I thought where you were going to go is Bobby Witt Jr., kind of the 1-2. No. And I think people are kind of drawing that parallel, and I don't view them as I view them similar in the sense that there is a 1A and 1B with a college player and a high school player. But I think the Riley Green hit forward, hit confidence safe high school profile is the sort of profile you get here with Grady Emerson. It's not the typical, like,
Bobby Wood Jr.'s, but CJ Abrams was in that same class there where you had two guys who you're like, these guys are big league shortstops.
Right.
Write it down. And then it was, how much are they going to hit? That was the craziest sounds as it sounds right now with Bobby Wood Jr. But that was the question. The question with Bobby Wood Jr. at the time, everyone believed in the speed, the athleticism, the defense, the power, the arm, all of that was there. It was, will he hit enough to get to that? The answer is
exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, you know? he wound up hitting enough. But yeah, there were swing and miss questions. If anything, like Grady and Bobby Witt are kind of inverted prospects where it's like they the hit tool. I don't remember. I mean, Termar Johnson had a very highly
again, praised Green's hit the one that works out because he has lived up to it largely. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a little bit interesting because Riley Green has become a little bit more, I would say, power oriented as a pro than maybe we thought. But you know, but at the same time, the hit tool is working, and I hate to throw Corbin Carroll as another guy in there because Corbin Carroll is more athletic. But the other thing about Corbin Carroll is like it's also hard to just very like Grady Emerson and Riley Green are at least a little bit more similar as far as like Corbin Carroll is the kind of the shorter version of all of this where you felt really good about the hit tool, but
right,
But the thing I would also say with this, okay, let's look at this from the White Sox perspective. If they took Grady Emerson one, like one thing that does jump out is if Emerson ends up being a significantly better bat than, say, a Rock Chulaski or let's say a Von Lackey, those are the three guys at the top, then this could end up making a ton of sense because you don't go wrong by picking if Grady Emerson ends up being an above average big league hitter with above average power. And when you say not a like slam dunk plus glove shortstop, we're also not talking about that this guy's a DH or anything like that either.
No, I think he's more likely to play shortstop than not. I just think it's you're basically looking at a solid average or a tick above average defender versus a potential gold glove winner. I definitely don't think Grady is someone who's like, oh, we probably going to have to slide him to third or second really quickly. I think he has all the tools to stick there for sure.
The other thing that I can't help but think about when we talk about Grady Emerson here is that I do feel like with the most successful top of the draft high school players in the 2020s, we're kind of recalibrating kind of the speed of these guys moving up. Like, I feel like if we were having this conversation in 2016, right, I would have a little less gray, you know, but if we were having it then, we would be saying, well, the downside of this though is let's say Rock Chulaski, if you're taking him, he's going to be in the big leagues start of 28 because, well, again, everyone was moving slower. But start of 28, maybe the tail end of 27. And Grady Emerson, you're probably talking about 2029, 2030, you know, kind of where there was a little bit longer runway it took for these guys. I don't think that that's necessarily as true, especially with a polished bat. Like, I'm not saying that we're going to see Grady Emerson in the big leagues, you know, in 20 – opening day 2028, a la what we've seen with Connor Griffin this year, basically. But what we may see is, like, I could absolutely, if the bat is as good as we think it is, I could absolutely see low A being no challenge for him next year. And then he's quickly in high A. And if you're in high A by midseason next year, it's not crazy to think that some point in 28, again, if you stay healthy, if everything progresses, I guess what I'm saying is the high school college long-term versus short-term, I think is maybe a little bit different at the top of the draft than we thought it was a few years ago.
I wish more teams would think this because it definitely feels like there are a lot of teams that think they just have to take college players because they can push them quickly. But I agree with you. I think the elite high school players, especially hitters, maybe wouldn't have this conversation for pitching prospects, but the elite high school hitters in a class, I do think can move quickly. They've shown in the past, there are a lot of examples that have done that. Maybe you're not getting the immediate big league jump that a guy like Rock Chulaski could make. But yeah, I don't imagine that Grady Emerson is a guy who's going to need to toil away in the low minors for a long time. So if you're worried about the ETA, Grady would be among the quicker assumed high school.
Right. Tracks. I would say much more, though, than some of the other names we're going to talk about today.
Right.
Okay. So the Rays are sitting here at two. And I would say in some ways, a dream scenario for them. Not that they would not be thrilled to take Emerson, I believe, if he was sitting there too, and they will also consider Lackey. We have a clear top three tier. But I also think that if you're sitting here at the Rays and you see that Rock Chulaski is still available, do they then say, okay, that's our, we're thrilled with how this all shook out?
I think so. Rock Chulaski would be the pick for the Rays in the scenario. For me, I mean, it's the best player in the class, still viewed as the best player in the class by most people in the industry that you talk to, even though we've talked about how the margins are maybe a little bit more narrow or have gotten a little bit closer this spring. But you're looking at a slam dunk, generational type college shortstop prospect. We haven't seen a player like this in at least a decade. You can go back more. I think Rock Chulaski is probably a better prospect at the same stage as guys like Dansby Swanson and Alex Bregman. Just feels like he's got more of a tool set on maybe both sides of the ball at the same stage. It just feels like if he falls into your lap, you just probably take him and don't think too much about it. I would wonder, like, we don't have this happening in this scenario, but I really would be interested in if the Rays would prefer Grady or Rock if they got to choose from both of them. Because I have just heard the Rays so connected to Grady Emerson, and it does
and their
feel
profile,
like
they
left-handed
love high school
hitting middle infielders, high school shortstops. Like, do they love them enough to take a guy like Grady over Rock Chulaski?
In the Von Lackey 1-1 scenario.
Yeah, I would like to see, like, actually, like, get an opportunity to see who they would pick from. But yeah, I think that Rock Chulaski, this is like maybe the least interesting pick of the entire alternate mock here, because I do think maybe what this could emphasize, it seems highly unlikely that Rock slides if he's not the first overall pick. Like, I just can't envision a scenario where he slides out of the top three for sure. And it just feels like Rock Chulaski would be picked before Von Lackey in this scenario as well.
That is, again, like, I will say, we're having an interesting discussion when we get to, you know, when Lackey was bored. Like, the selling point for Chulaski, what you just laid out, right? That you have the longest track record here of anyone that we're going to talk about as far as performing at an elite level. Mm-hmm. He was our college player of the year last year. We can say now, because we've already announced it, he is not our college player of the year this year, but he did have a very similar season to the one he had last year. I wouldn't say really better, but I also wouldn't say worse. It was very similar to what it was. And again, you have, like, with him, as opposed to the other college guys that we're talking about, you do have this longer track record. He was an elite prospect, a very well considered prospect coming out of high school. He's done nothing to dissuade that in any way, shape, or form in his time at UCLA. He leaves UCLA as one of the most storied players in Bruins history at a program that's had some very good players. I think that one's I think if you're the Rays, you are just – the only thing I would say here if you're the Rays is you have a lot of shortstops. I'm not saying –
Who cares?
Need,
Who cares?
But I will say – If you think that Von Lackey has a chance to be every bit as good as Rock Chulaski, the one thing I'll say that they've never had is that they've never had a catcher. But we'll cover that when we get back. I promise you guys, when we come back to this break, Von Lackey is going to go off the board at some point, and we'll find out if that's going to be at three right after this quick break. And we're back. So, okay, Emerson Chulaski, the top two guys on our board are off the board. Here we roll to pick three with the Twins. Is this an easy decision? Is this a tough decision?
Well, in the real mock draft, it would be an easy decision. It would be Von Lackey. But I do think that I've heard enough talk about Drew Burris being a model darling, and the Twins are a model heavy organization. And you mentioned that Rock Chulaski has the best track record of anyone we'll talk about. I don't know that that's the case.
You could argue.
Drew Burris, if you take his three-year track record, his last 3 years – I don't necessarily think they blow everyone out of the water, but it's pretty convincing Drew Burris's offensive production over his last 3 years of anyone that is available in this class. And I do think that on some teams' models, Drew Burris is sitting in a premium position. If your model really values extended track record, which a lot of them do, if your model really values the ability to put the ball in the air with consistency, which a lot of them really do, Drew Burris is going to show up great. And he is not the classic sort of, oh, scouts don't like him, but the models do pick, because Drew Burris is a center fielder with legitimate tools. He can run, he can throw, he has power. I do think there's a real scenario where Drew Burris winds up going in the top five on draft day, even if he is not consistently mocked there, and might not even be the top option for any of the teams there. If things happen, things get a little bit weird, I think he'd be a really appealing player for any of the teams in this range.
When we talk about track records, one other thing I think is worth bringing up. None of the guys that we are talking about college-wise at the top of this class have, and partly this is just an after effect of how the game has changed a little bit, but none of them have the elite Summerwood bat record that I would say is often a pro part of the, has been in the past part of this profile, right? Like, but for main reason is most of these guys have not played a whole lot. They did play Team USA, but Team USA last year was a very, you know, it was a small schedule, right?
And when they did play, they did not play well. No one did.
There's not a lot of Cape games or, you know, other summer college league games on any of these guys' schedules. And by the way, Drew Burris, Von Lackey didn't hit in their very limited. And I would say that Rock Chalowski, I mean, it was a little bit better, but none of these guys were like, oh, this guy was the star of the Cape, this guy was the star of the Northwoods League or anything like that. We're just seeing less of that now. And by the way, I don't know if it's as predictive because we're also seeing much less pitching in those leagues than we used to.
Yeah, the summer leagues are definitely a lot different than they were 10 years ago.
But I do think to your point, and you know that we, if anyone listening to this knows that I am a Drew Burris believer, like Drew Burris' freshman year is the best year that any of these guys that we're going to talk about have had. He just had the misfortune of that his best year, he's been very good since.
And I don't, I think this gets overplayed significantly. Like everyone's like, oh, you need to improve year over year. If you have a year like Drew Burris did as a freshman where you hit, you have a 1300 OPS, you hit 25 home runs, you get on base more than half the time. Like if your expectation cannot have the nuance to not, you don't always build on historic seasons, but he has been a metronome of consistency here. OPS over 1,100 every single season, 16 or more home runs every single season. He's hit over 300 every single season. There are even stretches this year where I was like, oh, this is like the Drew Burris down year. Early on in conference, he was struggling a bit, and it's still like his numbers are unimpeachable at this stage.
And I would also point out with that, that basically like, look, let's just get ahead of it right now. If Landon Hairston comes close next year to having the year he had this year at Arizona State, congratulations, because his year this year is, again, he's a sophomore.
It's a historic college baseball season.
It's hard to do better than that. You're just hoping to do similar to that again down the road. Okay.
Agreed.
So we are sitting here at pick four, and I would lay out that in this alternate universe, the Giants are probably like the camera pans to the Giants draft room and they're high-fiving, they're jumping up and down, like, because I can't envision a better scenario. We've talked about how much money the Giants have to spend and all that, all the, oh, are they going to figure out a way to get Rock to four, which as you laid out, very unlikely.
Right.
But in this scenario.
In this scenario, we're going to have Von Lackey go four to the Giants. And I think there are a couple things that are interesting with this, because one scenario that was floated to me with the Giants in preparation for the mock draft that went out on Monday, the actual mock was like, hey, it's probably unlikely that they float a Rock Chalowski to four or a Grady Emerson to four. But like, if they really want whoever is third in the mock or in the actual draft, like they might have the bonus pool money to make the difference between pick three and pick four. Maybe that helps them. I think the other element here that makes it even more interesting, if you're a Giants fan, you're like, please let us like slide someone to four. The Twins are a team, one of two teams. It's the Twins and the Rockies. They're not cheap. They're cheap.
When it comes to this, they are unilaterally disarming themselves when compared to, they are not taking advantage of something that 28 other teams take advantage of.
The Twins are one of two teams that has never spent over their bonus pool. So what basically happens in the draft is you can go up to the full 5% overage. The only thing you pay on that overage is extra taxes. There are no penalties beyond that. Most teams push close to the 5% overage.
It's Twins, the Rockies accepted standard.
I've not done that. Right.
That Agreed. Makes you cheap.
Fair enough. I push back on the cheap in the draft narrative a lot, because every team spends their full pool. Will say for the Twins, they were picking fifth overall in 2023. They were picking at the back of a top tier of the class. They gave Walker Jenkins an overslot deal to lock him up. So it's not like the Twins can't possibly go overslot. They've never done that. It's just the totality of their bonus pool, they probably could spend a little bit more. So that maybe is an element that could make this more likely. I still think as I mentioned in the actual mock draft, it seems very unlikely for any of the top three to not go top three, but this would be a tremendous win for the Giants if you want to secure one of the elite talents of the draft here.
What I'm just saying here, okay, I'll explain my cheap comment. Yes, you're spending millions of dollars in the draft, right? However, if you have something that is allowed and is a slight competitive advantage, because obviously having more money to spend gives you a chance to sign another player for a little bit over slot in the day three, whatever it is. And if there are two teams out of the 30 who are like, nope, we don't do that. And you say, well, why not? The only answer for why not is because it costs money, because there's no other penalty to it. You don't lose draft picks down the road. Nothing like that happens. All that happens is it does mean that you have to pay more money out, both in bonus and in penalty. And 28 teams say it's such a small amount of money, it's well worth it if the draft lines up the way we want it to. And if you're in, I hate to say it, but if you're in a boat with the Rockies, you and the Rockies are the only team who haven't done this, that's not a good boat to be in, is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
So, okay. Let's talk a little bit about Lackey, though, okay, because we haven't really talked about him. Obviously, here we have Buster Posey, Buster Posey's team drafting Von Lackey, who it's a great draft, I would say, in the first day. How this now today is what draft day will be like this year. But in day one for college catchers, right? There are we're going to hear a number of names go off the board. We just got done picking our college All-American teams. And I would say that was one position where I had way more players that I wanted to honor than there were spots to honor them. What makes Lackey the clear number one out of that group and puts him in this, what we've talked about, kind of this top tier?
I think Lackey entered the season with a reputation as the best defensive catcher, or at least 1A or 1B in some order, with Ryder Helfrich entering the year. Compared to Helfrich, who is also in like the top two tier of college catchers, his contact ability is far greater than Ryder Helfrich, and he answered the one question of his profile this spring, which was how much impact do you have? How much power do you have? He had a huge home run jump this year. The exit velocities were improved. And so now you look at this profile and there's really not a clear flaw. I mean, he's not a plus runner, but he's a real solid runner who will turn in above average times. That's a really good runner for a catcher. He can play literally every position on the field. And I think if he was not a catcher, he would be a legitimately good prospect at a number of other defensive positions. It's not just like, hey, you can put him there and hide him. Mm-hmm. He is an outlier athlete on top of being a potential gold glove sort of defender at catcher. And now you're looking at least an average hit tool with above average power potential. It's just a lot to like. And I think what I keep coming back to with Von Lackey is he probably provides the most value of any player in this class if you get little to nothing from him offensively. There is a path. We've seen it in the past. Patrick Bailey currently right now is a valuable big league player despite not giving you much offensively because he is the game's best defender. I think Von Lackey has that sort of defensive upside. And if he hits, you're looking at like a perennial all-star type player.
I do look at him and think, if you told me 10 years from now, Von Lackey, of the top guys who go to top five, Von Lackey ended up being the best one. Like, he's a catcher. There's a lot of risk. There's injury concerns that you have there that I would say are significantly higher than these other guys we're talking about. But it would not surprise me at all. Like, it is amazing to me. We will keep studying this, keep laying out stuff about this. But like, when I've tried to dive into it, I feel like that really, if you slice away the surface level traditional stat data for both Rochelowski and Von Lackey in 2026, and you go like, okay, now let's go down to the more analytical data, what their contact rates are, how hard they hit the ball, you know, their swing and miss in the zone, all these other things. It's amazing how similar it is this year. They've had underlying years are very similar this year. Now, as you noted before, Rochelowski has a much longer tail behind him of where this is the player he's been, whereas Von Lackey, it is something where he's had to ramp up to effectively have a very, again, traditional stat wise, he had a better season than Chalaski this year. I don't think that's any, like, I don't think there's really an argument. He hit, like, playing better competition generally, he hit like 60 points better in batting average, had a higher OBP. I believe he had a higher slugging too, you know, all those things. But I would say underlying, they had very similar years. The thing for Lackey is what you just laid out, which is if you get that out of a catcher and he can keep doing this in pro ball, that could be really special. Mm-hmm. However, Adley Rutschman, who we just talked about earlier, is a perfect example of this, right? Which is Adley Rutschman and Adley Rutschman's best has been exceptional, but he is a catcher. He's also had stretches where he's been hurt and he's played hurt sometimes where it's like, where did Adley Rutschman's bat go? And it comes back. But it's like he has to be, you just have so many things that are kind of limiting that way because of the grind of that position. And also on top of that, you're going to play fewer games because of that too. So it's an interesting calculus, but very interesting player. Now, okay, I would say in this scenario, this lays out how even with Drew Burris being kind of a surprise pick at three, you get to the Pirates and it's going to be kind of free form, but there's probably not going to be something other than, okay, who do you like best out of the second tier, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually think I have a more interesting wrinkle for the Pirates here in this alternate scenario. One of the nuggets that I thought was super fascinating when doing reporting for this last mock draft was Alabama shortstop Justin LeBron as a potential fit for the Pirates. I was very surprised. Well, I wasn't surprised for the reasons we'll talk about here, but LeBron is a player who does seem to be having the sort of conclusion to his year in the postseason that will be encouraging to teams willing to take a chance on riskier players. And perhaps no team more than the Pirates have been willing to take high-risk profiles in the draft in recent years. They took Connor Griffin before he was the Connor Griffin, who was universally regarded as the best prospect in baseball. The Connor Griffin they took was toolshed, athlete. Is he going to hit? Is he going to hit? They took Seth Hernandez. They were willing to take on the risk that comes with the infamous high school right-handed pitcher demographic when other teams wanted really nothing to do with that. What if they take a shot on the best tool set and athleticism available in the draft at this stage? That is Justin LeBron. I've heard him specifically mentioned as a possibility with Pittsburgh in this scenario. What if it's something where they're saying, hey, like he has equivalent tools and upside to each of the top high school hitters available on the board in Jacob Lombard, in Eric Booth Jr. Jackson Flora is good. We've heard him linked to the Pirates quite a bit. I think he's probably the most realistic option in this scenario. But what if they're like, hey, we've got a lot of really good pitchers. We need to add more infusion of hitting and offense. We like to swing big. There is no swing bigger at this stage than Justin LeBron. So I think this would be a tremendously fascinating one. I think five for the Pirates is probably one of the earliest realistic, even if it's not the most likely landing spots. And so for this exercise, I think it's a really interesting name to put here.
It is a fascinating name to put here. And as you said, like Justin LeBron did not have the season, I would say, overall that you want to see for a guy who goes five. At the same time, the trend lines are picking back up. He has been more reliable defensively. Like I said, there's never been a much of a question about his tool set to play there, but he's been much more reliable defensively lately.
Right.
He was a key. He's been the star that Alabama expected him to be and needs him to be. That's why they're in Omaha.
JJ, how often have good defensive shortstops had struggles in the minors and made a lot of errors in the minors? I think I don't really worry frequently.
I can only come up with about two or three shortstops I can say I feel comfortable saying over the past like many, many years where you say their unreliability never went away, and so that was prevented them from playing shortstop. I think you could say that O'Neill Cruz, like you could say other things, but I would say that O'Neill Cruz's unreliability at shortstop was a limiting factor of him at shortstop because he made too many errors. Like, again, it's a different way that, like, when people complain about Ellie De La Cruz, and it's like, yes, as a 22-year-old, Ellie De La Cruz just made an error on a play that no one else would try to make. Those are the kind that go away. Very few, like, again, errors at the big league level, you just don't have a whole lot of shortstops where you're like, if the ball's hit to him, I don't know if he'll make the play. That just isn't part of the game. That teams can really drill on that. But This is also fascinating because, again, I know that we're not talking about, again, the MLB draft's not about need, but we are talking about, in this scenario, you are drafting a shortstop at five, and you have basically the most cornerstone of cornerstone shortstops locked up on your team into the 2030s. And I would say, cool, bring it on. If Justin LeBron's what you think he is, and he's your second baseman, because again, I will say, I don't think, even if let's say that he's 5% better than Connor Griffin at shortstop, this is a little bit of something where when your face of the franchise is already established there, you don't go like, hey, Connor, we think LeBron might be like a little bit better than you. We need you to move. That's not something you normally do. But hey, if Justin LeBron is what teams hope he could be, he would be an impact player again, whether that's
second or third. I mean, the simplest way to underline it with Justin LeBron is if he hits, he has a chance to be a star, a legitimate star. And I think that is a profile that while there's tons of hit risk, significant hit risk, I wouldn't blame a team for taking a swing at that.
Okay, so that moves us on to pick six, the Royals. And in this alt world, they have this board is lined up crazy. They've got a lot of a plethora of opportunities here.
I think they would love this scenario if you're the Royals. I mean, basically what I hear is like Jacob Lombard sounds like the preference for Kansas City. And in this scenario, they're picking from maybe all of their top high school prospects at the board. Like, I assume they don't think Grady Emerson is getting to them. In fact, I feel pretty confident that they know that Grady Emerson is not getting them. They're not scouting him as a realistic possibility to get there. So let's do Jacob Lombard, shortstop out of Florida, high school shortstop out of Florida for the Royals. Again, I don't want this to be a let's throw every curveball draft. It's more like alternate realities. And I think basically what I'm getting at is like, I think in this scenario, Jacob Lombard would be the preferred target and he's here. So let's not overcomplicate things. In some ways, Jacob Lombard is the high school version of Justin LeBron. He is an exceptional athlete with power, with speed. If he's not the best defensive shortstop in the high school class, he's second to only Aiden Ruiz. He is impeccable with the glove. He moves fluidly. He moves as you would expect a high school player with his familial ties to the game. I do think that there are, I mean, we talked about it on a podcast recently. He has some of the same swing and miss concerns that guys like Ethan Holliday, Elijah Green had at the same time in terms of pure miss rates on the circuit. But you could say he's got pluses across the board outside of the pure hitting ability, and his spring, while it is high school competition, you maybe can't feel as strong about the takeaways and the growth from a pure hit perspective that you can for the college players. He had a really good spring, and he had a lot of really good feedback from scouts about what the swing was looking like, the performance. And so I think on the high school side, Jacob Lombard is probably the biggest upside player in this class, and getting that at six could be pretty appealing for the Royals, who, like the Pirates, also kind of have a stalwart at shortstop. But again, I would just love to emphasize, it does not matter that you have a good big league shortstop now if you think the best player in the draft is a shortstop. It is maybe, outside of pitchers, the least problematic position to double up on. So take the player. Jacob Lombard could be a perfectly good or great third baseman, second baseman, outfielder. He could play all over the diamond if you need him to.
To just kind of take that a little further, right? I know that you hear White Sox fans say we're covered at catcher. We don't need a catcher. If the White Sox thought that Von Lackey was just the slam dunk best player in the draft, I don't think that Edgar Cuero or Kyle Teal or anyone of that sort should be like, nope, we can't take him. We're locked up there. But we see this with the Orioles with Sammy Basayo and Adley Rutschman. They're like, hey, it's a good problem to have. But what I would say is exactly what you're saying. Shortstop, that's like you just basically got a multi-purpose tool. And yes, if you need a screwdriver, it's a screwdriver. If you need, you know, a pliers, it's pliers. Shortstops can do that. I did want to ask you, in this scenario, you've mentioned Jackson Flora before. Do you think there's any scenario where they might go down that road and say like, hey, we didn't expect the best college pitcher in the class to be still on the six? Or does it seem much more likely that they're kind of going a little bit more of the higher upside high school choice?
Yeah, I can rule out Jackson Flora by any means. I certainly hear a lot more of the high school names around the Royals, and I don't feel like Like, if the Royals were much more interested in Jackson Flora, I feel like we would hear his name more frequently, because we only really hear him associated with the Pirates and maybe occasionally with the Giants. It's not like Jackson Flora is like definitely going to be off the board in front of him. And so, like,
yeah, it's very
us not hearing about him with the Royals is a result of that. And so I do think, like, it seems like they're more interested in some of the high school pitching options, particularly Gio Rojas, who they've been super heavy on. I think Gio Rojas has more upside potential than Jackson Flora. But no, I don't think he would be like a out of the realm of possibility option for them. I think the talent would fit here fine. But I do think for seven,
We're going to get there. But before we get to seven, we're going to take one more break. Then you're going to find out who the Orioles are taking right after this quick break. And we're back. Okay, so Carlos, at seven, the Orioles picking here. And again, in this alt universe, the board is a little jumbled. Where do they go?
Well, I think it probably doesn't work out. Maybe kind of does, kind of doesn't. But the best player available in this scenario is either Jackson Flora, who is a pitcher who the Orioles just do not take at the top of the draft. And I would not be expecting them to take a pitcher.
It would be a whole new world
if he got here. But I have heard that the Orioles really do like both Jacob Lombard and Eric Booth Jr. And in this scenario, Eric Booth Jr. is available. And so let's make him the pick. I think Eric Booth Jr., like Drew Burris, and maybe even more than Drew Burris, is a prospect that appeals to both model-heavy teams and scout-oriented clubs. His collection of athleticism and tools, physicality in his build is really impressive. I think the contact pop up the middle position profile that Eric Booth provides is maybe the most exciting in the high school class. Maybe you could say it's the most exciting in the class. Additionally, he's a left-handed hitter. The Orioles have taken a lot of left-handed hitters. He's young for the class. He's going to be basically just 18 a few days before the draft starts. And so I think he checks a lot of boxes for really a lot of teams in this top 10 range. I think a number of the teams are interested in him at some level because of that. I really feel like it's unlikely that he falls much further than this range. I would be stunned if Booth, kind of the back end of this top six group we're talking about in the class, slips out of the first 10 picks. And so that's why, even in this alternate mock draft scenario, it's hard to not make him the pick here, although there are maybe five or six different college hitting options that could be intriguing as well.
We've said kind of consistently, like, that Booth, kind of, here we are, it is pick seven, even in an alt universe world that we're saying plausible but less than our 50% plus likelihood options here. We still have five of our top six on our board off the board by pick seven. That's right. To me, like, again, kind of lays out that there really does feel like, I get it, like, we have that top three that we talked about. Then we have that group right behind them, which I would say the thing that seems to be the separator here, and I'm asking you, but my sense is the separator is when you talk about the Lombards and the Booths, as opposed to these college bats, there's many more kind of like different permutations of how teams may line up that group of college hitters, as opposed to, there is a clear, it feels like, delineation that most teams view that these are the best three high school hitters in the class. And then there's a drop after that.
That feels right. I think that's accurate. I mean, there are some teams that have Jacob Lombard a little bit lower because they're more scared about the swing and miss. But I think collectively, teams are still viewing these top six players as kind of the top six.
As you said, also, the other thing is that putting mocking the Orioles taking an outfielder high in the draft is also not a surprising thing. They do that very regularly. So
too many outfielders.
Okay. A's at eight. In this scenario, I'm wondering if Jackson Flora gets popped or does he keep sliding?
Yeah, let's take him off the board here. Let's make Jackson Flora the pick. I think in some ways, if you're the A's, this is a dream scenario. I've heard that the A's want to add more pitching. They're picking in a range in the draft this year where they might just not have great options available if they want to do college pitching in particular. In this scenario, they're basically saying, hey, we have our choice of the top pitching prospect in the class, whoever we think is the best pitcher. It's been straight hitters so far. I do think Jackson Flora fits as a really good value at this spot at number eight. I think for the critiques you could have of his profile, he really does check a lot of boxes. I mean, the fastball is a chance to be a plus pitch with good life and power. He has diversified the arsenal to a significant degree. We've talked about that and written about that a lot at the site. His changeup that he's added is a real plus offering now for many scouts. And I think he has the delivery, the body, just the athleticism on the mound to make strides in the areas where he's going to need to continue improving, which is the command and the execution and the consistency of his pitches. I think he is a mid-rotation starting package. And if you can sharpen up the command, maybe you could get a little bit more. But this would be a pretty solid win if the A's are like, we need to add pitching here.
Which, by the way, adding him to Jamie Arnold, who they took last year, Gage Jump, who just made his big league debut a couple of weeks ago.
This would feel similar to the Jamie Arnold pick from a year ago, where you get a player who could have easily gone in front of you and you just happily scoop him up when he makes it to you.
Okay. So here we go to the Braves at 9. And until last year, I would have probably said, hey, so the Braves, I know we just said that a pitcher went off the board, but the Braves were pretty much all pitchers all the time, but they've readjusted. They are now at the point where the lineup of guys who are signed into perpetuity has gotten a lot closer here. Mm-hmm. The Ozzie Albies, the Ronald Acunas, there are a number of these guys who are no longer like, oh, they're going to be, they're under contract for the next 6 years. That's kind of stopped. They had a more position player heavy draft. If you're listening to this or watching this on YouTube, do check out. We did a whole kind of like 20 minutes on the Braves farm system and how it's improved this year up earlier this week, because they really have kind of taken strides. That's kind of setting the stage. What do you see? Where do you see the Braves going here?
Yeah, I feel like they could go in a number of different directions, and this is really the board where the board starts to open up here, because we've cleared the top tier of the class. I've heard a lot of college hitters with the Braves. We hear Gio Rojas tied to them. I'm not sure how seriously to take that rumor, because I mean, they just have taken a lot of high school pitchers. Would they want to take one here at 9 after they started pivoting to more of a hitter-centric draft approach a year ago? I'm uncertain of that. I've heard them tied to AJ Gracia, Chris Hakopian, who'd be really appealing, bat-oriented college prospects. But the player that makes a lot of sense to me in this scenario is Tyler Bell, the shortstop with Kentucky. I feel like one of the things that stood out to me in this latest round of mock draft reporting was that every team picking in this 8 to 16 range is really enamored with Tyler Bell. I think he gives you a lot of what we talked about with Grady Emerson at the very top of this alternate draft, which is kind of safety throughout the profile. He does not have the most explosive tool set. He does not have the sort of power that you maybe could get with a Hakopian or with an Ace Reese or with an AJ Gracia. But he is a switch hitting shortstop who really understands the strike zone, gets on base a ton. He didn't play a full season this spring because he had a shoulder injury in his first game. But when he came back, he was a tremendous performer. He was a high pedigree player coming out of high school. And so I think there's a lot of comfort with Tyler Bell, both in his track record of hitting over the years and also just the defensive profile and the profile in general of a safe college shortstop prospect. He might not have a plus two on the card, but I don't think you can point to him and say he's above average in any specific area as well. And so I think he's just a really well-rounded player who's going to appeal to basically every team in this range.
Again, we were talking about also like he's a pretty surefire, like the defense, you're getting value there. You're getting a hit tool, and then we'll see how the power develops. But
right,
pretty good guy. And I think the only in this alt universe, I think that still is a pick that matched what you picked in our previous, in the most recent mock draft, because
yeah, sorry if you wanted more variety, Braves fans.
I think they'd be pretty happy with Tyler Bell. But they use a shortstop. That's been the position that they've kind of been struggling at for years here. Okay. Last pick of this, because we're doing 10 picks here, the Rockies. I mean, for one, let's just start by saying, I feel like that this is the Rockies and where they go is probably more kind of, it'll be interesting to see than any other team picking in the top 10, because I think you could largely, I know that there's still like, it'll be interesting to see if they follow a part of what they've been doing. It's a lot of the same people there, a lot of the same scout, you know, like there's still a a core of people there who were been involved for years. But at the same time, it's also under a completely new head of baseball operations in Paul DePodesta. What do you see the Rockies doing here?
Yeah, I just want to echo your comments. I'm really curious to see if there's an obvious like trait or sort of profile they're going for. And we're going to have multiple opportunities to see if there are any consistent traits linking their first three picks, because they pick here at 10. They also have multiple picks in the supplemental round at 37, 38. Maybe because they have those picks, I've heard the Rockies tied to a lot more high school pitching than I would expect for them. But for this pick, let's shake up the sort of hitting profile that they're going with. Let's do Derek Curiel, the outfielder at LSU. He is not a player that I would have put at this specific pick a week ago, but I did have some conversations in the reporting for this mock draft that Derek Curiel is a name that they're interested in. I think, again, like the Braves pick with Tyler Bell, this is similar to the mock draft. But I think talking through the Derek Curiel pick and maybe what that could indicate for what the Rockies might be trying to do. Again, we'll see if this actually happens. But Derek Curiel is almost the antithesis of a lot of the hitting profiles the Rockies have targeted in recent years. He is very much a hit first, makes a lot of contact. There are power questions. And I do think that Derek Curiel's offensive profile would be really interesting and really fun to me in Coors Field, because I think he would be a player. Obviously, most players are going to benefit by hitting in Coors Field, but he would be able to pepper those gaps and get a lot of extra slugging from doubles in a really fun way. And I think he is the sort of defender who can stick in center field without having the elite 70 or 80 grade running ability. I've talked about this throughout the spring. I think Derek Curiel is a really well-rounded player. I would take him even higher than this if it was me. But again, I think along with Tyler Bell, like once Tyler Bell is off the board, I feel like Derek Curiel is one of the most popular college hitters in the draft at this stage.
One thing I want to ask with that is that, because we haven't talked about it on the podcast since this came out. Curiel came out and said, yes, I was hurt. I was injured in the offseason. I think he basically said, I'm not going to tell you exactly what it was, but it wasn't a great idea, whatever it was, but he was injured. And he kind of carried that into the start of the season, played through it, and then did get better as the season went on. How much do you think that might factor into as teams evaluate Curiel?
I think if you're a team that had concerns with Derek Curiel or maybe negative reports on him early in the year, it gives you a reason for why he wasn't playing up to what your expectations might have been. And you might feel a little bit better about his slow start to the year, because yes, like you said, it felt like every college hitter, once we turned the schedule into conference play, everyone started to struggle. That wasn't the case for Derek Curiel. It felt like he was starting to kind of hit his peak form against conference play. But I also think that Derek Curiel has just such an extensive track record as a high school player that teams are going to have a lot of comfort with him regardless. They'll certainly want to get a better understanding of what the actual injury was, if there are going to be any lingering effects from that. And I imagine they'll get that information as we get closer to the draft, if they haven't already. But I think ultimately the biggest question with Derek Curiel still is like, how much power are you going to get? And does that power question prevent you from taking him in a spot right here inside the first 10 picks?
Okay, to wrap this up. So here we are, we've gone through 10. Even though this is very jumbled, and this is kind of a lot of like, okay, we think this is, if this is 55-45, let's go with the 45, or the 60-40, let's go with the 40. The other thing that stands out is that kind of goes back to the stratification of this draft. Mm-hmm. I feel like at pick 11, in this alternate world, you're still talking about a scenario where 11, 12, 13, 14, it's kind of a lot of the same names that even if you said the most chalk mock draft you could have, still a lot of the same names.
Yeah, I think once you get here, it's a lot of the same names. The one name in this version that maybe does shake things up a little bit is Justin LeBron. And maybe by like looking here and seeing the shortstops who have gone off the board, if you're a team picking in the middle of the first round, there might not be a lot of shortstop capital for you to pick from. Maybe that changes if guys like Aiden Ruiz get pushed up the board a little bit more, Landon Tomei, Cole Prosek, some of the maybe an Eric Becker moves up because of that. So like there are some ripple effects from this, but I do think, yeah, going through the process, for me at least, highlights like there is a clear tier of six players, it's hard to envision scenarios where those players fall. There are not a lot of obvious super far off the board names that make a ton of sense to jump into this range, which maybe makes LeBron one of the more interesting players, as he has been throughout the entirety of the spring.
But that is our look at an alternate reality top 10 pick mock draft. There will be many more. We are working. We just are putting the finishing touches on a staff draft that we've been working on because we like doing those too. We go a lot deeper than 10 picks, I'll tell you that. But we're doing that right now as well. And obviously, there is going to be so much more coming at baseballamerica.com. If you want to get ready for the draft, we will get you ready. We will give you everything you need to get you ready for the 2026 MLB draft, whether your team is picking one, like the White Sox, or if you're like the Dodgers and you're going to have to wait around a little while to hear that first pick. We'll get you ready for it. For Carlos, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.